Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're jumping into something really fascinating, historically just packed with detail. The Picatrix.
Right, a medieval guide basically on astral magic.
Exactly. And it pulls from everywhere, doesn't it? Greek thought, Egyptian stuff, Babylonian astrology, Arabic science, even Indian natural philosophy. It's quite a mix.
It really is. And what's important for listeners to grasp right off the bat is the specific version we're looking at. So it's a translation, and it was deliberately framed to reflect how someone back in medieval Europe, or maybe the Renaissance, would understand it. Someone educated in the seven liberal arts.
Right, so even though his roots are super diverse, the lens we're using, the one in this translation, it's got a very distinct Eurocentric feel.
Precisely. It doesn't really dig into all the original layers of the Arabic text, the Gayat al-Hakim. It's more about how it was received and understood later in Europe.
Got it. So our mission today, yours and ours, is to really unpack the core ideas in this version of the Picatrix. We want you to get a feel for its worldview, some of its, well, surprising bits, and what this old text might still tell us.
Sounds good.
Okay, so let's dive in. This idea keeps popping up. Perfect nature. What exactly is that in this context?
Ah, yes, perfect nature. It's a really central hermetic idea woven all through the Picatrix.
Hermetic. So relating back to Hermes Trismegistus, that whole tradition.
Exactly. The connection between us, the microcosm, and the universe, the macrocosm. And this perfect nature, it's presented as a kind of ultimate goal, a telos, an inherent purpose.
Okay.
And interestingly, it's sort of built into the structure of the seven liberal arts themselves. It's not just about learning grammar or geometry, it's about using that knowledge to reach this state of mystical fulfillment.
So how does a magician, according to the Picatrix, actually get there? Is it like getting a diploma in mysticism after studying?
Huh, not quite like that. It's much more active, more personal. The idea is the magician achieves this perfect nature by carefully aligning themselves with their governing planets, the ones from their birth chart, their nativity.
What I meant.
Yeah, and by sticking really rigorously to specific ceremonies and practices laid out in the text, the thinking is, through all this, a personal informing spirit, kind of, connects the individual directly with the creator.
Informing spirit.
Wow.
That sounds major.
It is. It's a really profound connection they're talking about.
So where does our everyday, imperfect nature fit into this idea of perfect nature?
That's a great question. Because the Picatrix actually stresses that even though the nature we see around us seems flawed, maybe incomplete, loving that nature is essentially loving God.
So it's all connected.
Everything is connected, yeah. And to help understand how magic works within this, the text talks about the womb being divided into three parts. You've got matter, spirit, and then intellect or mind. Grasping how those three interact, that's really the fundamental framework for performing any kind of magic described in the book.
Right, so you need that understanding of the cosmic structure before you can even think about doing magic. And where does magic itself actually come from in this view? Is it just a skill you learn?
Well, according to the Picatrix, magic isn't really a separate add-on skill. It's presented more as the almost the natural result of a life dedicated to holy contemplation.
Really?
Yeah, it's seen as the thing that connects the wisdom of figures we might think of separately, people like Moses, Plato, Aristotle, Geber, even Hermes. It suggests magic arises naturally from that deep spiritual and intellectual understanding of how the cosmos
That's
works.
quite a claim.
Yeah.
Now, anyone reading the Picatrix notices pretty quickly it's not exactly straightforward, is it? It's often really obscure, uses lots of figurative language. Why?
That's a really crucial point. The text itself actually gives a reason. It says the obscurity is deliberate, done out of honesty and goodwill.
Goodwill. How so?
The argument is that revealing this powerful knowledge too plainly would be dangerous. Humankind's ambition could misuse it, potentially even, destroy the universe. So it's meant as a safeguard.
To keep it out of the wrong hands, basically. Only for the good and in the service of God, as they
Yeah,
say.
right. That's the official line.
But you hinted there might be another take, a more cynical one.
Well, yeah. A more cynical interpretation is that maybe this obscurity also helped protect, shall we say, trade secrets among practitioners.
Keeping the competition out.
Pretty much make it hard to understand, and only the truly dedicated, or maybe the already initiated, can really use the power. And the text is full of warnings, admonishments against sharing secrets with the unwise.
And it sounds like this isn't just theoretical danger either. Like, misinterpreting this stuff could have real consequences.
Oh, absolutely. Real-world risks. The Picatrix has recipes, instructions for suffumigations, that's burning stuff for magical smoke potions, all sorts of concoctions. And if you mess up the ingredients, use the wrong thing, or consume something you shouldn't, yeah, it could lead to serious sickness, blindness, even insanity or death.
Yikes.
Yeah. The text kind of assumes the user, the sage, already has a certain level of knowledge about potentially noxious substances. It expects caution, but it doesn't always spell out the specific dangers, which could be, well, fatal for someone unprepared.
So powerful ideas, but also potentially dangerous practices if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Okay, you mentioned a specific cosmology underpinning the magic. Can you break that down for us a bit? What does the universe look like in the Picatrix?
Yes, understanding the cosmology is absolutely essential to get the magic. At the heart of it, you have the Prima Mobile.
Prima Mobile, first mover.
Kind of. Think of it like the absolute outermost shell of the physical cosmos, like the edge of everything. It's often described as a sort of veil covering the Empyrean, which is God's realm. Yeah, and this Prima Mobile is what drives the daily rotation of the stars we see. But it's also imagined as being like a perforated screen, almost, shielding us from the full, overwhelming light of God.
So God is beyond these spheres.
Exactly. God's dwelling place is seen as being beyond all these cosmological layers, out in infinite space.
And this whole model, as you said earlier, it wasn't invented just for the Picatrix, right?
Not at all. It has really deep roots. It's drawing on centuries of Greek thought, Egyptian ideas, Babylonian astrology, Arabic science, Indian philosophy. It's a synthesis, a bringing together of all these ancient traditions to create a consistent foundation for the magic described.
Okay, so a complex layered universe model. Now, who was this Latin version actually for? Who was expected to read this obscure stuff and handle potentially deadly ingredients?
That's a really interesting question. And one way we can get clues is by looking at what the rituals are for. There have been something like 2,325 distinct magical rituals identified in the Picatrix.
2,300, that's a lot.
It is. Now, part of that number comes from how their catalog sometimes breaking down bigger ceremonies into smaller steps. But if you categorize the aims of these rituals, you get a sense of the user's main concerns.
Okay, so what were people mostly trying to achieve? Wealth? Power?
Surprisingly, no, not primarily. The biggest category, the one with the most rituals, is actually interpersonal relations.
Relationships, like love spells and stuff.
Exactly. Rituals for influencing love, friendship, but also causing enmity or hatred between people. It suggests that managing relationships was a huge concern for the readers of this text.
That is surprising. I'd have guessed power or money.
Well, personal health is also a big one. About a sixth of the rituals are health-related, covering a wide range of ailments, which tells us a lot about medieval health concerns.
Makes sense. What else?
Then you have a lot of what are called apotropaic rituals.
Apotropaic, meaning like warding off evil.
Yeah, warding off misfortune or actively getting rid of nuisances, killing them, binding them, and the list of targets is really down to earth, you know. Ants, bed bugs, bees, birds, dogs, fleas, flies, frogs, leeches, lice, mice, wasps.
The everyday pests of medieval life.
Okay,
what about the bigger goals? Profit. Influence.
They're definitely there. Rituals for profit are mentioned, specifically linked to things like success in law, battle, medicine, being a scribe, even selling perfumes.
Oh, yeah.
But here's an interesting imbalance. There are significantly more rituals aimed at destroying or diminishing someone else's wealth than rituals for directly gaining wealth yourself.
Wow, that's kind of dark, spiteful magic.
A little bit, yeah. And then, of course, there are rituals for gaining magical power itself, sort of boosting your own abilities.
Right, makes sense. One thing missing, though, you mentioned alchemy.
Yeah, there's relatively little alchemy in this text, the Picatrix. That's likely because there is often a companion text, the Rutbat al-Hakim, that focuses specifically on alchemy. So the Picatrix seems more focused on the astral magic side of things.
Got it. What about travel? Was that a big deal?
It pops up, yeah. Rituals for safe travel, both by land and water. The fact they exist suggests the readers weren't just stuck at home. They had some mobility, maybe for trade or other reasons.
But it was risky.
Clearly. The rituals themselves highlight the dangers people felt were associated with travel back then. Both normal dangers and maybe supernatural ones, too.
It paints a picture of people moving around, but feeling quite vulnerable.
Okay, let's shift to something a bit unusual for modern ears. Psychoactive substances in the Picatrix.
Ah, yes, the suffumigations again. This is fascinating. The text often prescribes burning very specific substances, herbs, resins, animal parts, in quite large quantities for certain rituals.
Large quantities, so lots of smoke.
A lot of smoke. And it's highly likely, given the ingredients sometimes listed, that these practices would have induced pretty powerful mind-altering experiences.
So it wasn't just for smell or atmosphere.
Oh, much more than that. These altered states were thought to be crucial. They were seen as a kind of bridge.
A bridge. Yeah, a bridge connecting the magician's ordinary mind to the, let's say, subconscious realm of forms. The place where planetary spirits were believed to exist and could even descend into the adept's mind.
Wow. So you're deliberately altering your consciousness to access these other levels of reality.
That seems to be the idea, yes. To gain access and influence within those realms.
Okay, so magic here involves actively engaging with different realities. How does the Picatrix itself talk about the different types of magic you can do?
It lays out a kind of hierarchy. At the top, you have operating spirit to spirit influencing things on a purely non-physical level.
Okay.
Then there's working spirit and matter. That's where things like talismans and magical images come in physical objects imbued with specific astral energies.
Right, like we discussed.
And finally, there's matter in matter, which is basically alchemy transmuting physical substances. Though, as we said, that's less of a focus in this particular book.
And how do they define magic overall?
Pretty broadly, actually. Basically, anything that's hidden from our normal senses. Anything whose causes aren't obvious to most people.
And talismans. We call them force bearers.
Yeah, that's what the text says the wise call them.
Yeah.
The idea is you create them by conquering the substance they're made from, imbuing it with specific planetary influences at exactly the right time, under the right celestial conditions.
So understanding the heavens is absolutely non-negotiable for this.
Yeah.
How did these sages even get that understanding according to the text?
Through two main things: deep, dedicated contemplation and really careful, detailed observation of the world's sense perception.
Observation and thought.
Exactly. And this ability to grasp profound truths through focus and reflection was even seen as a kind of divine gift, something that elevated humanity.
A very holistic view, inner understanding, linked to outer observation. Okay, let's get practical. How does this detailed astrological knowledge actually translate into making these magical images?
Well, astrology is absolutely fundamental. The text basically calls it the science of magical images. The constellations themselves are the foundation.
And the planets.
The planets' positions, their relationships to each other, the aspects at the exact moment you create the image, that's what determines its power and precisely what it will do. It's all about timing.
Can you give some examples, like really specific ones?
Sure. Say you wanted to create lasting love between two people. The Picatrix says you make two specific images.
Mm-hmm.
When a fortunate planet is rising in the east, the ascendant and the moon is in Taurus, together with Venus. And you need specific number inscriptions, too.
Wow, very precise.
Or for gaining favor from kings, make a specific image under particular planetary conditions, then bury it right in the middle of the city.
Bury it in the city. Okay.
And for a physician to make more money, you'd make inscriptions on thin tin plates, lamellae, with specific images precisely when Taurus or Libra is rising, and Mars is also in the ascendant.
Okay, so the timing and planetary positions are incredibly specific for each goal. What about more mundane things, like that safe travel we mentioned?
Yep. There's advice for that, too. It depends on the moon's mansion, basically her position against the background stars and other planetary aspects. For safe journeys, or maybe destroying an alliance, or even fostering affection between spouses, you'd often want the moon rising in one of the human signs, Gemini, Virgo, Libra, etc., while she's well-aspected, avoiding bad influences from Saturn or Mars, or being too close to the sun.
It sounds incredibly complex.
It is. Even the nature of the rising sign itself matters, whether it's a torturous or direct ascent sign, and whether fortunate or unfortunate planets are aspecting key points. It's a whole intricate system.
An intricate system of celestial influence. Now, amidst all this cosmic machinery, what about humans? What's our place in the Picatrix's universe?
Humanity gets a pretty elevated status, actually. We're described as a unique, image-bearing internal light, powerful in spirit, well-proportioned physically.
Internal light.
Yeah. And we have this amazing capacity to understand what helps us and what harms us. We're seen as diligent, skillful, capable of learning incredibly complex things.
So we're not just puppets of the stars.
Not at all. Humans are credited with the ability to perform miracles, create these wondrous magical images, and preserve knowledge through generations. We're even called the author and explorer of God's wisdom, the one who explains his qualities, the knower of all things, even huge cosmic events like planetary conjunctions.
That's a powerful view of humanity.
It gets even more interesting. The text says our senses can comprehend the intelligences, the spiritual beings in the spheres, but they can't fully comprehend us.
Really? So we have an edge, in a way.
Seems like it. And the text is pretty clear. Everything else in creation serves humankind, but humankind serves none of them, not in the same way.
Wow.
Even our ability to imitate all animal sounds is mentioned as proof of our special nature.
Definitely a human-centered universe they're describing.
Okay.
Okay, let's switch back to the physical world. What's it made of, fundamentally, according to the Picatrix?
The world we sense, the sensible world, has two main parts. First, there's elemental form.
Earth, air, fire, water.
Exactly. And these are seen as transmutable. They can change into one another. But then there's a second, more fundamental part. Universal matter.
Universal matter.
Think of it as the underlying stuff that's ready to receive any form. And this potential stuff is composed of the simple qualities. Heat, cold, dryness, wetness. But unlike the elements, this universal matter itself isn't considered transmutable. It's the potential beneath the change.
Like a substrate. Okay, now, the Picatrix also talks about decans. What are those?
Right, decans, or sometimes called faces. Basically, each of the 12 zodiac signs is divided into three 10-degree sections, so 36 decans in total.
And why are they important?
Because the Picatrix associates very specific, often quite vivid, images with each decan.
Images? Like pictures in the sky?
No, not literal pictures. They're symbolic descriptions meant to convey the specific powers and influences active in that particular slice of the zodiac.
Did you give an example?
Sure. For the sign Aries, the first face, or decan, is described with an image of a man holding a severed head. The second, a woman in linen with one foot showing and an angry horse face. The third, a red and white man with red hair holding a sword and a staff.
Okay, definitely symbolic.
Exactly. Things like a mutilated head or severed hands aren't literal. They symbolize concepts like death, weakness, or the specific interplay of planets in that decan. The Picatrix sees understanding these symbolic images as absolutely essential for mastering magic.
Like a visual code for complex influences. Now, what about the planets themselves? How varied are their effects?
Incredibly varied. The text stresses that a planet's effect changes constantly. With every single degree, it moves through the sky. And it depends heavily on whether it's alone or in conjunction, close alignment with another planet.
So it's never simple.
Never simple. Even the moon's basic qualities, like how much moisture or heat it brings, are described as changing continuously based on her phase relative to the sun. Whether she's waxing or waning affects humidity, temperature, even how plants grow differently.
And do specific planets link to specific activities?
Oh, definitely. There's a strong connection made between planets and certain human activities or social roles. Venus is linked to youth, pleasure, women. Jupiter relates to clergy, kings, lords. Mercury is about messengers, scribes, intellect. The sun connects to royal deeds, kingship.
So knowing these associations is crucial for magic.
Absolutely crucial. You need to align your goal with the right planetary energy and timing.
Right. So how does someone actually improve their fortune or even gain the ability to prophesy, according to this text?
Well, the Picatrix suggests that really deeply understanding the world's qualities, how they're unified but also distinct, that's what leads to what it calls prophecy.
Prophecy like seeing the future.
Not necessarily in the crystal ball sense. It seems to me more like a path of profound understanding, moving from the physical world we see to the metaphysical realm, the underlying principles. And achieving that understanding is seen as fulfilling our highest human potential, leading to a state of, well, perfection and blessedness.
So knowledge itself is the path to a higher state. How does all that theoretical understanding translate back into making those magical images, the talismans?
Harmony is key. The text really hammers this home. The image's shape, its specific purpose, the material it's made from all have to be in perfect agreement.
Agreement with what?
With each other, and crucially, with the powers and influences of the specific planets governing that type of magical work. Everything needs to align, the intention, the materials, the celestial timing, get that right, the text implies, and the image will be much more powerful.
A multi-layered alignment. What about the fixed stars versus the planets? How do they interact magically?
The Picatrix explains that the stars' effects basically follow the effects of the heavenly spheres they're embedded in, because the stars themselves don't really have independent motion in this model.
So the seers dictate the stars' influence.
Pretty much. Their effects happen in accordance with the bigger movements of the heavens. The text also brings in prima materia first matter, calling it the first nature and author of truth. Even the raw materials used have to accord with these cosmic principles.
Okay.
And a planet's effect can also be changed depending on its position relative to other planets, whether it's ascending higher or opposite another planet in the celestial order.
It really is all interconnected. What happens when planets get close together in conjunction?
Good question. Conjunctions have three main qualities described. Augmentation, where one planet strengthens the other. Diminution, where one weakens the other. And balance, a more neutral or moderating effect.
Can you give an example of weakening?
Sure. The text specifically notes that when the moon is conjunct Saturn, a heavy, restrictive planet, the moon's usually fluid, changeable effects get weakened or constrained.
So even good influences can be dampened. What are the absolute core principles a magician needs to remember, according to Picatrix?
Similarity and sympathy. These come up again and again.
Similarity.
Yeah, like when making an image, there needs to be a similarity between what you want it to do, the qualities of the stars you're calling on, the properties of the metal or stone you use, the exact time you make it, and even the place you make it.
And sympathy.
Sympathy and mutual love. The sage is advised to always focus on harmony, avoiding anything that creates dissonance or antagonism in their magical work. Keep it harmonious.
Harmony and alignment seem key. Now, the text also mentions the orderly arrangement of nature. What's that about?
That refers to the old belief in a kind of hierarchy in the natural world, different ranks or degrees.
Like a ladder of being.
Sort of. The Picatrix lists six composite natures. The elements, the simple qualities, hot, cold, wet, dry. The qualities of the soul, the seasons, the bodily humors, blood, phlegm, etc. And then plant-based things like tinctures, oils, roots, seeds.
Yeah.
And it links the qualities to the elements. Heat comes before fire. Humidity before air, coldness before water, dryness before earth. It's a very structured view.
Very structured, almost Aristotelian. Can we get into some really specific examples of the rituals themselves? What were people actually doing?
Oh, absolutely. There are loads, for instance, to bring someone specific to you. Draw certain figures on linen rag on Venus's day and hour when the second face of Taurus is rising with Venus in it. Then write their name and burn the rag.
Okay, quite specific. What about causing trouble?
For creating enmity between two people, draw different figures on black lead using a black dog's tooth during Saturn's day and hour, then bury the lead somewhere specific.
A black dog's tooth.
Yeah.
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 And the text gives detailed descriptions of the images representing the planets themselves. Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, Sun, Venus, Moon, their forms, colors, what they should be holding. And materials. Did each planet have its own stuff?
Definitely. Specific metals, lead for Saturn, tin for Jupiter, etc. Certain stones, types of cloth, colors, and crucially specifics of fumigations, the incense or smoke used.
So you needed the right incense for the right planet?
Absolutely. The text even mentions specific places known for good materials like brass from Andalusia or alcohol from Cordoba. And it includes weird stories about strange occurrences in certain locations, maybe hinting at localized magical energies.
Like what?
Oh, things like a colorless man causing fever in one town, weird vipers on a mountain, houses infested with spiders and deadly beasts, a special stone found in mastic tree holes in Africa. It adds a layer of mystique.
It really does. You mentioned a story about a servant girl.
Yeah, a detailed account of a ritual to make a servant girl who'd been sold return. It involved making images, burying them, burning candles, reciting specific words. It really shows the practical application people envisioned.
So for someone trying this back then, what's the practical advice for making it work?
Alignment is key with planetary spirits, stellar influences. Proper preparation is huge. Using the rites of fumigations, maybe fasting or dietary restrictions beforehand. The fundamentals listed are precise timing, planetary hours, correct suffumigations, perfect belief in the outcome, frequent fasting, lots of prayer, using ritually clean or worthy places, and nailing the astrological aspects.
Perfect belief. Sounds important.
Very. And the text adds that your request is more likely to work if you direct it to the lord of your nativity, the planet ruling your birth chart.
Your personal connection.
Exactly. Because the planet's power lies in the spirits that serve them, and those spirits carry out the effects. You should serve each planet in its proper hour.
Makes sense. Any other tips?
Heavier, slower planets like Saturn and Jupiter are said to have more powerful, lasting effects. Don't try to force things against a planet's nature, like seeking union from Mars, planet of strife, or separation from Venus, planet of love. That won't work well.
Work with the grain, not against it.
Right. Treat comets like fixed stars in your calculations. Seek Mercury when he's in a pure sign. Generally work with the moon when she's waxing, growing brighter.
Okay, and the words themselves.
Yeah. Magical words need God's power and grace to link the heavens and earth effectively. Images need to be made of natural substances, empowered with potent words, and again, avoid antagonism. Harmony.
It's this blend of astrology, spirituality, and practical crafts. Even the traditional liberal arts fit in here, right?
Yes. The seven liberal arts, grammar, rhetoric, logic, arithmetic, geometry, music, astronomy, are seen as foundational. Geometry, for example, is mentioned for practical uses like measuring land, lifting weights, making discoveries, directing water flow, even building things like aerial instruments or incendiary mirrors.
So a good education was part of being a magician.
Absolutely. Understanding the principles of the world and cosmos was essential.
Let's circle back to Suffumigations. What more does it say about their power?
It highlights the Indian practice of using them specifically to attract planetary spirits. The recipes given are generally meant to work for invoking each planet.
And the ingredients could be pretty weird.
Oh, yeah. For Saturn, think things like henbane, opium poppy, mandrake root, but also maybe myrrh and frankincense mixed with foul stuff. Jupiter gets things like nutmeg, cloves, sandalwood, ambergris, generally pleasant things. Mars involves pungent stuff, maybe euphorbium, bdellium, sulfur, often complex mixes.
Complex and specific. And there are prayers, too.
Yeah.
Directed at the planets.
Yes, specific prayers and conjurations. Examples are given for the Sun, Venus, Saturn. They usually involve calling on the planet by its names and powers, then stating your specific request very clearly.
Like asking for favors.
Exactly. The text mentions sages praying and making sacrifices in mosques, sometimes linking the number of sacrifices to celestial movements, supposedly following Hermes' instructions. And interestingly, they avoided sacrificing animals that were multicolored or black.
Ritual purity seems important. Any weird Saturn practices?
Yes, some specific Saturnine practices mentioned include washing with wine and salt, using a locked house for rituals, and using suffumigations made from things like old hides, animal fat, sweat, even dead bats or mice, all done under favorable astrological conditions, of course.
Dead bats. Lovely. Is there a Saturn prayer example?
There is. It emphasizes Saturn's great power, asks him to sharpen the petitioner's senses, and grant protection after death. It shows real reverence, seeking a deep connection.
Definitely. What about magical stones? Any examples?
Two main ones stand out. One is described by Aristotle to Alexander as a stone surpassing all wonders, made from a complex mix of materials shaped on a lathe.
Wow.
Another is the Helemetes stone, used against bad weather like rain or hail. It's described as tawny colored and made from things like hellebore, wolfsbane, silver, and lead.
Potent stuff. And the text includes some pretty intense potions and remedies too, right?
It really does. There's a recipe for animating an image that involves human and animal blood and brains, nutmeg, camphor, all mixed in cow fat, poured into the image and sealed.
Okay, that's graphic. What about counter curses?
Remedies against curses include using a frog's head and spine, something called Berber's aloac, a donkey's brain, or carrying peony root in silk. It even mentions marvels pertaining to magical operations with the human body.
Intriguing and slightly disturbing. What other odd properties or remedies are listed? It seems like a real grab bag.
It really is. Let's see. Carrying an umbilical cord or a frog's tongue brings honor. Oil from blood for skin problems. An Indian way to magically attract water with a pillar. A mixture with human penis, opium, datura, and arsenic to paralyze someone.
Good grief.
Specific love-inducing rituals with actions and words. A ritual to make someone hate a sold servant girl. A mirror used with suffumigations to summon entities. Trees in India that don't burn or can move. One that sounds like human voices.
Okay, getting into traveler's tales territory there.
Maybe. Then properties of plants like costus, staghorn, cumin, saffron, chalk, salt, fleabane. Algae that won't burn. Intoxicating effects from wine with chickpeas or a stone called atambari. A magnet reacting weirdly to garlic and ram's blood. A deadly snake in the river Sarek.
Keep going. This is wild.
Spider web for quartan fever. Ostrich cries repel snakes. A mix to paralyze birds. Sea, hair, forehead, curdles meat. Gold burning and mouse droppings, apparently.
I'm learning so much useless trivia.
A plant causing intense skin irritation and its remedy, another plant causing 3 days of sleep and how to wake someone up, leaves that heal wounds instantly, a plant that kills snakes or scorpions if they're bound with it, saw for stings, purslane for headaches, magically creating tarantulas from basil.
Creating tarantulas. Okay, that's a new one.
Images for causing impotence. Mansion-specific rituals. One for separation using an image of a dog chasing its tail. One for friendship with a seated man holding paper. One for destruction with a two-faced man image.
Based on the moon's position.
Exactly. Prayers just to the moon. And a ritual of writing names on a sleeve and burning it for love and friendship.
It covers,
Yeah.
well, pretty much everything imaginable, from the
Yeah.
cosmic to the creepy crawly.
It really does. And, as we wrap up this deep dive, we've really only skimmed the surface, but we've hit on the key things. That idea of perfect nature, why it's written so obscurely, the unique cosmology, the huge range of rituals for all sorts of human worries, the total reliance on astrology and planetary timing, and just these incredible glimpses into how people in the medieval period saw magic intertwined with the natural world.
Yeah, it's definitely a shortcut into a really complex and important historical text,
Yeah.
absolutely packed with surprising details and ways of thinking that are pretty alien to us now.
For sure. And when you think about this mix, the deep spirituality, the super precise astrology, the very hands-on, sometimes bizarre practical magic, it really makes you wonder, doesn't it? What does this tell us about how people back then saw their place in the cosmos, how they related to it all?
That's definitely something to chew on. A completely different relationship with the universe. Thanks for breaking it down for us.
My pleasure. It's a fascinating text.